the body of Islamic knowledge that we have in the form of the Quran and Hadith, and try to kind of fathom what has been said in it. Perhaps this is the reason why it has been narrated from Imam Sadiq that he said, "One tradition that you understand is better than 1,000 traditions that you merely narrate." And also, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Alaykum bid dirayat." Your aim should be the understanding of the traditions, la bir riwayat, not simply the narration of them. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the value of learning a tradition in the words of Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
This one lay. Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Detention and swift removal. The British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has outlined a harsh approach when it comes to asylum seekers, going against its obligations under international human rights and refugee law. As the UN put it, the UK is considering a British draft law that prohibits legal asylum seekers from applying for UK citizenship. Now, why has the UK taken such an approach when it comes to asylum, which practically amounts to a ban on it? And the bigger picture, why have many European countries adopted such a stance? That's the focus of this edition of The Spotlight. Let me introduce our guests. Clive Menzies, political economy analyst and researcher, joins us from London. Also joining us is Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, who joins us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Clive Menzies, looking at what Rishi Sunak has said regarding this British draft law, detention and swift removal. I guess that's the slogan, somewhat, where those entering the UK in small boats will be detained and swiftly removed and will not be given, obviously, any type of asylum or claim on it. What's your reaction to that?
I think that I don't actually hold a lot of faith in anything Rishi Sunak says he's going to do. But there's a much larger context to this. In 2012, Peter Sutherland, who was the UN migration envoy for a while, former Goldman Sachs banker and oil man, said that the cultural homogeneous nature of European countries had to be destroyed effectively. And this was articulated by Richard Kudinov Kalergi in 1925. Induced mass migration has long been a weapon of war. And what we've seen in the 20th century was two world wars, which destroyed a fair amount of European culture. And the EU was a product of that. It was kicked off by the CIA. So there's been this constant move towards breaking down the cultural fabric of Europe generally, and we've seen that continue. And what we saw in August 2015 was unprecedented. All of Europe dropped its immigration controls, and governments, NGOs have been actively colluding to actually direct immigration flows. not just into the UK, but in the UK particularly. There was a huge propaganda effort in August 2015 with this young three-year-old boy who allegedly had drowned on the beach somewhere in Britain. And it has been a constant move to actually inject people into the UK. The Home Office has now taken over the overseas development budget and is paying for hotels. These immigrants are getting fairly large amounts of support in terms of phones, bicycles, credit cards. And the amount of money they are receiving is a multiple of what your average old age pensioner receives. Now, this is not between us, the indigenous population and migrants. This is the structure that is trying to divide and control. Uh-huh. And so I think whatever may be said in Parliament is pretty immaterial, because
right.
you have to see what's being done rather than what's being said.
Well, first of all, there's a number of different angles there that you said, to say the least, Clive Menzies. Gilbert, Dr. Al, what do you think about what our guest there from London has said? I'm particularly interested in whether you agree with him where he said, if I understood you correctly, Clive Menzies, where he said government and NGOs have been colluding. Do you think that that's the case?
In a sense, yes. But I think the bigger issue before us was also mentioned by my fellow panelist, and that was the word war. What we are seeing in England and its measures to frustrate, if not put an end to, the boat people arriving on its shores is the result of direct actions by England, France, other NATO countries led by the United States in destroying a whole series of countries in North Africa and the Middle East. These are the migrants that we're talking about. They are people of color, and they are people with a different cultural background. That's all true. But they are all the victims of wars inflicted on their region, which created failed states. These are not economic refugees in the normal sense. They're people whose homes have been destroyed by NATO, by the United States, and so they're arriving. It doesn't have to be that way. Migration is a worldwide phenomenon, and economic migration continues and flourishes in other parts of the world. I just spent 2 weeks in the Middle East, in Dubai and Oman. And there I saw, in Dubai in particular, 85% of the population of Dubai is guest workers, largely coming from the Indian subcontinent. They're all people of color, and they all have cultural traditions different from the 500,000 native population of Dubai. 3.5 million are from Pakistan, India, Sri Lanka, Nepal, and further afield in the Philippines. These are people of color who have come to a country where they are received and made welcome and are given opportunity to earn savings that they then take back to build houses or enterprises. Mm-hmm. And it works. So the argument about a cultural difference or about a racial difference is not a persuasive argument. The issue with facing England is what England itself has wrought by destroying whole swaths of North Africa and the Middle East.
And that is one of the key questions and topics that needs to obviously be addressed here, Clive Menzies. So tell us your views on that, because it's just from a pure humanitarian I shouldn't say humanitarian, just from a ethical point of view, you can't go and be part of a war in another country and then not accept the people who are suffering the consequences of that war.
I wholeheartedly agree that war is a major factor in this. But I mentioned the structure, and I would say that the economic migration, if you like, is a product of the plunder that has been conducted across Africa and across the world, because effectively what the structure does is it harvests the population and any population resources available. They've done it domestically in the UK, in the US, across Europe, but the game has always been to go and plunder elsewhere. So to talk about economic migration actually ignores the fact that the reason there is economic migration is because we plundered those countries, we plundered their resources. You look at the CFR states, the Central French Republic, former CFR states, that have ostensibly have an independent political system, but they are subjected to French economic policy. And so you take a country like Burkina Faso that has gold and has resources, they don't see the value of that, neither the people digging it out of the ground, nor the government or the state and the population. It's the French government that benefits. And, you know, you could say that for South Africa, you could say it for... So economic migration is a product of this structure that is basically harvesting domestic populations, migrant populations. It's harvesting us all. What we need to realize is that we're not here to fight each other. We're actually to reorganize ourselves in a way that makes sense in the light of ethics, as you referred to. You know, if we lived in line with universal law and we had a system that allowed us to do that, then there would be no economic migration. Yes, people would move around, and that's to be welcomed, because I think cultural integration has been a great benefit in many respects. But wholesale invasion of the type that we've seen in the last, 5 to 6 years, more than that, creates huge tensions between populations, and we need to talk to migrants. Migrants need to talk to the indigenous population and understand the real source of our problem is not each other, but the structure under which we are plundered and harvested and, in the case of war, killed.
Okay, when it comes to economic migration, there's obviously a point or a reason when it comes to that happening, Gilbert Doctorow, for people not to find either jobs or their economic needs to be satisfied, so they leave their country and they migrate to different countries or seek for asylum, and then hopefully in hopes of finding a job. And Europe is one of the destinations. Now, what's interesting here is that in Europe in particular, and specifically in the UK, there's a great need for workers in general. Based on one particular stat, 1.1 million arrivals a year could be the start of a trend that this particular source says for maybe the next decade to come. These people can fulfill that need there of jobs that many of the indigenous population, to use our guest Clive Minzi's word, they don't go for those jobs. So why should governments try to stop these people from coming into the country?
Well, there are immigrants and immigrants, and the racial issue and the cultural issue comes to the fore. When I spoke about the 350,000, or these 3.5 million guest workers from the Indian subcontinent working in Dubai, they could have applied to go to England. Did they? No. They understood full well that they are not welcome for these cultural and religious reasons, and they went to a place where they are welcome. And where they can, where they're obviously doing fairly well, because despite all of the remarks in Western media about exploitation of construction workers and so on, in Qatar before the games, the reality that I saw, when you have 85% of the people around you are guest workers, if they're not having a good day, you as a hotel guest will not have a good day. And they all seem to be having a good day. So it works. It doesn't work when they come to the UK, because the overlay of religious diversity poisons the well. And this is a form of racism that cannot be denied. I also pick up remarks of my fellow panelist using the word plunder. I think that when I spoke about war as the driver of mass migrations from states that have been ruined by European and U.S. military interventions, you have to look at what happened in Libya, which had been holding back the economic migrants from sub-Saharan Africa. And those migrants were not war-driven. They were driven by what my colleague said, plunder of the colonial states.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
The issue of race is pretty evident when it comes to one particular country, and that's Ukraine, Clive Menzies, where we can see that Europe is actually facing, because of this double standard, something they've been accused of, where they will allow the entrance of Ukrainians into the country, the UK obviously no exception there. But when it comes to people from West Asia, obviously there is a discrimination against that. Isn't that an important point to highlight here?
Well, I live in London, and my partner is currently in intensive care. And I think I may have spoken to one Indigenous doctor, and I've been speaking to nurses, doctors, and they're from every continent. I feel exactly the same towards them as I would anybody else. And I do not see this in this racism that people talk about. Yes, I'm sure there are people who have a bad attitude, but living in a multicultural community as I do, I don't see it. And I think that the problem is that these headlines that refer to sort of deep racism are misleading. So when it comes to Ukraine, there's a whole different ball game at play, because actually, as we've discussed on other programs, the Ukraine war started in 2014 with Ukrainians killing and harming Russian speakers. 13,000, I think, was the number that died up until the beginning of Russia's military action. And one is also seeing anecdotally, and I've not studied this in depth, of Ukrainians actually going back at Christmas to see family, or going back for a holiday. So I think the issue of Ukrainian migration is quite special. And there's clearly a lot of propaganda that has been supporting this war, which is not as portrayed in the main media. I mean, this is an existential war for Russia, but it's NATO basically trying to destroy Russia. That's what Ukraine is about, and Ukrainians are the victims in this, both Russian speakers and the Western population.
But the issue of race is a big one, isn't it, Gilbert Doctorow? We know that many EU leaders whom they have been labeled as populist leaders have gained both notoriety and popularity in many EU countries, and they were actually put into power because people in those countries, and maybe you can tell us which countries are most famous for that, actually hold the same views. They say they don't want people from other countries taking their jobs away, for example, and maybe mixed in with some form of discrimination against them. Haven't these populist leaders actually used this issue for their own purpose in terms of coming into office or coming into power?
Well, as a general rule, I would agree with that proposition, but I don't quite agree with the remarks of my fellow panelists with respect to Ukrainians. Yes, the Ukrainians are blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and racially desirable for for large parts of Europe, in Poland in particular. And it's not just a racial issue, it's a cultural issue. In the case of the 1 million or more Ukrainians who are said to have settled in Poland since the start of the special military operation, they are welcome because they are hardworking people. They share, their language is very close to Polish. Within a few months, it is fairly easy for Ukrainian, particularly from West Ukraine, which is still closer linguistically to Polish, it is easy for them to fit in and become productive members of the local society. So they also meet demographic needs of Poland and Germany and other countries, as far afield as Italy, which have been experiencing sharply declining birth rates and are concerned about maintaining their working populations. So the Ukrainians fit into a special slot. As I say, they're both culturally, in terms of their physical appearance, and linguistically. And also, they are unlike Russians. They are easily managed by Germans, by Poles, who feel comfortable with them. They don't feel any cultural challenge that they feel, for example, in dealing with Russians, who have too much self-respect to accept the overlordship of the Poles or the Germans. So it's a special relationship. But as regards other migrants, yes, of course, in Germany in particular, the extreme populists have used the migration issue as an electoral talking point.
Okay, taking a look at London and what Rishi Sunak is doing here, Clive Menzies, when you take a look at some of the statements coming from him, it doesn't jive with what the reality is, especially when it comes to the part about how these migrants or asylum seekers are not a result of, for example, wars. And I'd like to get a quote from him on this if I find what he has said. But basically, many are opposing some of the views that Sunak has here. What is the UK then going to do? Some of the things it has said, one of them that's pretty alarming, is that they're going to detain these people. They're going to then deport them either to where they came from or to Rwanda. What's your feeling on that? I mean, is that that sounds a bit harsh, doesn't it?
As I said earlier, I think, you know, what the government and Rishi Sunak say and what they will do are probably two different things. And there may be some cosmetic propaganda to illustrate that they're doing what they're saying they're going to do, but I don't actually hold a lot of store by that. But I want to pick up on your other guest's point about population, declining population, because this should be seen in the context of another agenda that has been progressing through the 20th and 21st century, which is population reduction, reducing birth rates. And there's a huge discussion about how eugenics turned into Planned Parenthood, and I won't go there. But if you look at, I found a study and published on LinkedIn a study that showed the birth rates following these experimental vaccinations actually led to an 82% spontaneous abortion. And the way the study was constructed, the abstract actually obscured that fact. But when you actually looked at the detail, that was the reality. And we're now seeing more and more confirmation of the problem with these vaccinations and birth rates. So what we're witnessing in dropping birth rates is a combination of factors, not just the vaccinations, but the way in which sperm counts have dropped. There's been a wholesale assault on reproduction, and this and also policy to deter people getting women out to work. And you know, there's been a whole shift to actually reduce the population. Left to themselves, Europe would thrive, but they've been working under a set of regimes that actually inhibit reproduction.
Sure. All right, final question, Gilbert Doctor, out to you in less than a minute. You're looking at the top countries at this point, the UK, ranking from number five. I believe you have Spain, Italy amongst the top five. This problem is going to keep continuing. You have people in the respective countries, such as Libya or other African countries, as an example, who will exploit these people who want to leave those countries to come to Europe. But what kind of solution would you think could be something that could appease the whole situation? Less than a minute, please.
Well, there is no easy solution to this. I think Mr. Sunak is like the other populist politicians in Europe. He's facing an election next year. He's a shallow personality. He is the UK's Macron. And he seized upon an issue in which he can look tough and decisive. This is all PR and appearances. It has no content.
Thank you, Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst. Clive Menzies, thank you, political economy analyst and researcher from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kava Tapwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, philosophy of tawassul. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the philosophy of tawassul in the Islamic lifestyle. In the journey of perfection, when it is said that it is necessary to have the tawassul or to do tawassul to the Ahlul Bayt, to the prophets, or to the saints or awliya Allah, it has a philosophy behind it. The first thing which we can mention is that there are many people, and the most of the people, we should say, they are the ones who do not know how to reach to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, how to reach the perfection, and they are unable to identify the right path, although there is a right path. On the other hand, we see that when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created us, He never left us on our own. He never left us on our own. What He did is He basically provided the means of perfection, the means of guidance for us. And therefore, the means which He provided were the prophets on the first number. The second thing was the books which were sent to these prophets. And the final version of the book is the Quran. Therefore, it is necessary that for all of us, in order to get the perfection, to have the tawassul. And the philosophy of tawassul is, since we do not know the way, since we cannot differentiate between good and bad when we are on our own, therefore it is necessary to follow someone who's been trained by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and He is in this world for our guidance. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the philosophy of tawassul in the Islamic lifestyle. We mentioned that the first thing which we can mention is that there are many people who don't know how to reach the perfection. And therefore, Allah has sent the means, and this is because we do not know what to do. And He never left us on our own. And this is a basic point that why all the prophets were raised, why the infallibles were sent, why the books were sent, they all were there for our guidance in order to take us towards the right path. They are the guidance for us, and this guidance is been provided by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The prophets were trained by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and therefore it is necessary to do the tawassul. And this is the philosophy, the first thing. The second point is that these guides who are being sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, these are the ones who are who are the most loved people in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah loves them the most because they were so pure, and Allah knew in His, according to His knowledge, that they are the most purified people in this earth, and that's why Allah made him the prophets. That's why Allah trained them and He sent books through them for us, and therefore He put His love in our hearts. You know, when we talk about Imam Hussein alayhi salam, even if someone is not a Muslim, he also loves Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein has done for the mankind, even the Hindus, the Christians, the Jews, the Muslims, no matter which religion you follow, when you hear about Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the sacrifices he made, you love him. Why? Because he was there for humanity. He was there for the mankind. And therefore, we can see that the philosophy of Tawassul is that it is all for our guidance. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Dozens of people, many fleeing war and persecution, risk their lives every day in makeshift boats like this one, crossing the English Channel to seek asylum in the UK. But a new government bill here is about to change that.
People must know that if they come here illegally, it will result in their detention and swift removal. Once this happens, and they know it will happen, they will not come and the boats will stop.
The previous government's so-called Rwanda plan that would see migrants deported to Rwanda has not been implemented after legal challenges from rights groups. The government argues the law will stop the business of people smugglers. The UN has called the bill a clear breach of the Refugee Convention, and rights activists say it is unethical and unworkable.
It's absolutely ridiculous. People will continue to exploit vulnerable people who are desperately trying to flee oppressive regimes, you know, flee from countries where they have no hope, no rights, and no future. People smugglers don't care about processes and procedures and what will happen the other end. They care about collecting their money and making sure boats or trains or whatever pushes out with human cargo on it.
2022 saw a record 25,000 people arriving in the UK by boat. 31 died trying, raising questions about the functionality of the UK's asylum system.
Well, it certainly isn't fit for purpose. It is very, very bureaucratic. But it also takes too long to, for instance, give those claiming asylum with the skills and experience that we are very short of here in the United Kingdom.
And then there's Brexit. Before it, the UK shared a returns policy with the EU that allowed it to send migrants back to the countries they had first arrived in. There is no such deal in place now.
The bill is unlikely to face much opposition in the building behind me, where the Conservatives have a majority. But we're yet to see how it'll fare in the courts. Critics are also saying that it's a gimmick by the government to win more votes among its Conservative base at the next general election. Saeed Purza, London.
An alliance of six Turkish opposition parties has nominated Republican People Party chairman Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu as the joint presidential candidate. Kılıçdaroğlu will be running against President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in the upcoming May 14 elections, with mayors of Istanbul and Ankara, Ekrem İmamoğlu and Mansur Yavaş, to be appointed as vice presidents. This was the condition of İyi Parti leader Meral Akşener to rejoin the alliance after a debate last week, where she refused the naming of Kılıçdaroğlu as the alliance's candidate, which led to her quitting the bloc before rejoining on Monday. Kılıçdaroğlu not only aims at ousting President Erdogan, but also to reverse many of his policies on foreign affairs, economy and civil rights.
As the nation's alliance, we will rule Turkey with consultation and consensus. The six opposition parties of the Nation Alliance have agreed on a strengthened parliamentary system. During the transition to the parliamentary system, the leaders of other parties will be the vice presidents.
The Justice and Development Party, or the AKP, was counting on opposition parties' failure to find a consensus candidate. However, now that most of opposition parties, including the biggest one, has agreed on one candidate, many believe the opposition has a bigger chance to topple Erdogan and his alliance.
The opposition is likely to win the election against Erdogan because AK Party lost its former popularity in the eyes of the public. Inflation, high cost of living, increase in the rents, etc. Also, AK Party doesn't have a new economic plan to offer to the people. As a result, election campaigns are very important here. If the opposition picks a good candidate, especially in terms of economy, like Kılıçdaroğlu, and if he convinces the public by presenting a proper plan, I guess he can win the election from the first round. Another issue is HDP's nomination. HDP may not nominate a candidate, which they probably will not, because Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu becomes a candidate now. If the CHP also holds a meeting with HDP, the opposition will win in the first round. The vote of the Kurds is very important in this race. If the Kurds lean towards Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, the winner of the election will most likely be the People's Republican Party in the first round.
Many believe the May 14 elections will be intense, as the winner will not only rule Turkey, but will also decide the future of the country for many years to come, including its foreign policy and economic strategy. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Italy is seriously mulling over resorting to developing its nuclear energy in this crucial geopolitical conjuncture. On Monday, three Italian energy firms, Ansaldo Energia, Ansaldo Nucleare and Edison Spa, announced that they have signed a letter of intent with major French utility Électricité de France, also known as EDF. The deal features collaboration on the development of new nuclear projects in Europe and, quote, to open a debate on the possible role of new nuclear power in Italy's energy transition.
L'obiettivo dichiarato da Edison è quello.
Italy's Edison Energy Company says it wants to produce its own nuclear energy starting from between 2030 and 2035. This would be obtained thanks to provisions which have introduced considerable simplifications of the procedures to build smaller and safer nuclear plants. However, the risk is that the projects may encounter strong opposition by local governments.
Italy closed its nuclear plants in 1990 after a referendum on atomic energy held 3 years earlier, following a new referendum held in 2011 when 94% of Italians voted again against the atomic option. The idea of a return to nuclear power seemed dead and buried. However, the energy crisis triggered by the war in Ukraine seems to have changed people's mind in Italy, according to latest surveys. While only 15% of Italians are fully supportive of nuclear energy, one in two Italians believe that switching back to nuclear energy could be a solution to the issue of high energy bills if safer and cleaner nuclear technology is employed.
I am in favor of the nuclear option because we already buy nuclear-produced energy from France and Spain. And if there is an accident at the plants over there, we would also suffer from the consequences.
Nuclear energy is produced by several European countries these days. Why not in Italy? Maybe this decision should be adopted at a European level.
The issue of nuclear energy came up again in Italy in 2021, particularly following the former Mario Draghi's government expressing support for the return to nuclear power in the country. This was then followed by a consensual agreement voiced by the current Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. Max Civili, Rome.
Supporters of the People's Democratic Party, PDP, marched through the streets of Abuja, chanting and condemning the results of the just-concluded presidential election in Nigeria.
Why did you go by 4 a.m. to announce the results? What was the hurry if you have the seven days window? And then the chairman said that I will listen to all the petitions before we conclude this process. He went ahead and concluded the process and did not open a window for the review of those issues.
The demonstrators say the Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, did not follow some provisions of the electoral laws in conducting the election and in announcing the results.
800.
The demonstrators marched to the headquarters of the INEC in Abuja, where they demanded unsuccessfully to see the chairman of Nigeria's electoral body. The opposition PDP and the Labour Party have separately approached the Court of Appeal, challenging the outcome of the February 25 presidential election. The Court of Appeal, which serves as a presidential election petition court, has granted the request of the two political parties for access to inspect sensitive election materials. The demonstrators here said the protest is necessary in view of the gubernatorial and state houses of assembly elections coming up on 11th of March.
What we are here to do first is that the issue of their infractions in the last elections will be dealt with by the court. But going forward, how are we going to resolve this for the elections we have on the 11th of March? That is the most important question on the minds of Nigerians today.
Meanwhile, Nigeria's president-elect Bola Ahmed Tinubu has appealed to the opposition to come and join him to work for the unity and progress of Nigeria. Nigeria's president-elect is expected to be sworn in May 29, 2023, once the courts have established him as the winner of the elections. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
It's another ordinary day for Shivina Khan and her family living in the eastern part of New Delhi. Their family starts their day by reading their father's letters, which he wrote in jail, pleading his innocence regarding the riots that broke out in Delhi back in February 2020. The violence claimed dozens of lives, shattered many families and destroyed their property, claimed 53 lives, mostly of Muslims.
My husband was going to work, but on the way, riots sparked and he called me saying the situation is bad. Please be safe. In another 30 minutes, he said the riots had started even near his office. He was questioned for several days before being arrested for crime he never committed. I have 3 children and it's really hard for us to cope up with situations.
Another activist and mother of jailed student Umar Khalid says Muslims are now treated like terrorists in their own country. She said all the charges against his son are politically motivated and a deliberate attempt to demonize Muslims. She says the so-called Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, which is a draconian legislation amended in 2019 by the ruling BJP, allows authorities to declare an individual a terrorist and keep them in detention without trial for months or even years.
It's been 2.5 years since my son is in jail. He was arrested on September 2020 and the charges framed against him are completely false and baseless. He was arrested in connection with the Delhi riots in 2022 and the 2 FIRs have been registered. One of the charges is UAPA and it's not easy to get bail if such a charge is framed. Media these days is supporting false propaganda, but we have complete faith in our judiciary and we will fight for his release from the Supreme Court.
Umar and Salim are not just only victims languishing in jails without trials. Activists and critics accuse the authorities of accusing Muslim community members of a crime they did not commit. Based on reports by Human Rights Watch, police investigation in the cases were marked by bias, delays, inaccuracy, lack of proper evidence, and a failure to follow proper procedures. Reports suggest that the Indian government has in recent years adopted various laws and policies that are discriminatory towards the country's minorities. The ruling party is also accused of infiltrating country's courts and police, empowering Hindu nationalists to harass, threaten and attack religious minorities with impunity, and cracking down on any dissent. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Iranians have observed the National Tree Planting Day as part of the Natural Resources Week by planting saplings across the country. The country has now launched a wider campaign to plant 1 billion trees in 4 years. Accordingly, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, marked the National Tree Planting Day by planting 3 saplings. Meanwhile, President Ebrahim Raisi went to the National Botanical Garden of Iran in Tehran to mark the event and start a campaign to plant 1 billion trees nationwide. The Natural Resources Week represents more than just planting trees. It's a strong message of protecting the environment and changing attitudes and lifestyles. Each tree means a gift from the current generation to posterity to have a green and healthy planet. National Tree Planting Day is annually celebrated on the 15th day of Isfand, the last month on the Iranian calendar. The day also marks the beginning of the National Week of Natural Resources.
Iranians have always paid special attention to nature. They believe planting saplings will make the world a better place to live for us, our children, and the generations to come. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran-Afghanistan Permanent Trade Center has been opened in the capital, Kabul. The center is in line with the two countries' policies of expanding bilateral ties and connecting business people of the two neighboring states. During the opening ceremony, Afghanistan's Minister of Industry and Commerce highlighted the country's expectations about trade between the two countries.
We expect to balance the trade with Iran. We want to export our goods to Iran, which enjoys a good market. Iran's export to Afghanistan is more than $2 billion a year, but I won't mention our export to Iran because it's a very small amount. We hope that Tehran modifies its laws so that we can increase our exports.
With the opening of this center in Kabul and its capabilities, it is believed that the Taliban government in Afghanistan is providing a platform for more economic connections between Tehran and Kabul.
This center is an example of good relations between Afghanistan and Iran. Both countries have a lot of potentials, and with the opening of this center, we hope that bilateral trade gets a big boost and Tehran and Kabul can be great partners.
This center has great capabilities which can have great effects on rebuilding Afghanistan and the war-torn country's infrastructure.
The priorities for this center are trade of industries, equipment and machineries, also food industry, mining industry and technology. We are also ready to set up an iron production line in Afghanistan. On the other side, mines and precious stones here are useful for Iran.
Iranian and Afghan officials hope that the center helps advance the export goals of the two countries. They highlighted that the development of sustainable trade and exports is the most important task of this center in Kabul.
Many believe the opening of such trade centers would have positive effects on Afghanistan's economy that has taken a lot of damage due to years of political and financial instability. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
Even though inflation remains at a 40-year high, United States President Joe Biden has terminated a program which provided extra food money for over 40 million of the poorest Americans. The elderly, the disabled, students, poor children, and the working poor are now forced to find an average of nearly $100 more every month to spend on food. With sanctions on Russia still massively backfiring across the West, grocery prices here have soared more than 11% over the last year.
The families aren't purchasing food at the same price that they were pre-pandemic. So apart from having families come in more often, we may start seeing families that have to cut back on their housing budget. So what they typically spent on rent, utilities, they may have to start dipping into that to pay for groceries.
Experts on food insecurity contend that food aid to the poor has been insufficient, and that was long before the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program started seeing cuts. The expansion of so-called food stamps was both popular and successful, leading to an immediate 10% reduction in the overall poverty rate and a 14% drop in child poverty.
Versus 2021, when a lot of the pandemic relief was in force, our numbers were actually down significantly. So we've seen our numbers grow from 2021 to 2022 about 40%. Give or take, we can only imagine what this next round will bring.
Without government involvement, citizens can only turn to charities for help. In states which have prematurely stopped the expanded food aid, food banks are already reporting a 40% increase in the number of visitors.
Last year, the ruling Democrats voted to end the pandemic's expansion of Medicaid, the federal program which provides a bare minimum of health care for the nation's poor. At the end of this month, at least 15 million people will also lose their health care coverage.
Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
By some accounts, the history of animation stretches back to the turn of the 20th century. However, the art finds its roots in antiquity. A 5,200-year-old vase found in Iran's burnt city in the 1970s features a series of five images that researchers have only recently identified as being sequential. Giving it a spin, one would see a goat leaping to snatch leaves from a tree. Fast forward to today, Iranian animations have made significant progress. While the first modern cinematic animations were produced in Iran about a decade ago, thanks to the efforts by Iran's talented youths, the country's animated movies have attracted the attention of a huge number of viewers. The number of high-quality animations has grown compared to previous years in Iran. The new award-winning animated blockbuster Lupetu is a perfect example. The name Lupetu is inspired by a word local people in Kerman province of Iran used to refer to handmade toys that mothers used to make for their children in the past. The animation is about a sanitarium where a doctor treats his mental patients by teaching them to make toys. An unknown culprit vandalizes the creative toy workshop, which is particularly popular among Iranian children, and causes its closure. The doctor's son, Ali, tries to help his father to solve the problem. The process of making the animation took over 3 years. It was ready to be screened in 2020. However, the coronavirus outbreak delayed the screening, and finally, it hit Iran's silver screens from early November 2022. The box office hit is one of the most popular on-screen films of Iranian cinemas right now. It managed to become the most popular movie in Iranian cinemas only within a month and a half of its release in the fall season. Lupatu has also taken part in various national and international festivals. Despite their success, the director of Lupatu says there is no room for complacency, adding, Iranian animation studios should redouble their efforts to keep up with the big names in the industry.
Iran's animation industry is progressing. It's perfect that children can watch this animation in the cinemas. But we have a long way to go. We should produce more high-quality cinematic animations to keep up with foreign animations.
Lupatu's producers say it will soon be screened in other countries, with Turkey and Russia showing interest to screen the animation in their cinemas.
Several high-quality cinematic animations have been made in Iran in recent years, and Lupatu is one of them. The blockbuster animation's success testifies that Iran has made significant progress that puts it on a par with big names in the industry.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Back to Reality. This is Asma. Just like always, I have the pleasure to be here. And in here, I have two very dear guests with me, Brother Hassanain and Sister Zainab from India. Welcome to today's episode.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, sisters, and assalamu alaikum, everyone listening to the IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
Alaikum assalam, and also from Anne, say salam to all of you and the audience.
So it's a pleasure to have you both in here. And just like always, we're going to have pretty much of nice stuff to talk about. There's this thing, sometimes as you sit alone with yourself and then you think about what is going to happen after I am no longer alive, you know? And then again, you would think that, okay, I have been living for 50 years and then after that I will die. And then there would be not a single footprint of my name everywhere. And I would be forgotten forever. Mm-hmm. So how does it feel? Have you ever thought about that? For 1 year, for 2 years, for 3 years, for 5 years, for 10 years. But eventually they're going to forget me, right?
Oh, well, the bitter truth that I have seen is that if someone dies, it's not just 1 year, 2 years, after just 4 days.
Yeah.
People slowly and steadily start forgetting.
No, let's just be optimist in this point and say after 10 years, they're going to forget me. And after that 10 years, there'd be no more of me.
Yeah.
It basically depends how much of value you had in amongst people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that determines, you know, how much will you be remembered.
Well, you know what? If I do not accomplish anything, if I do not write a book, mm-hmm. if I do not create, I don't know, anything special, if I do not invent electricity, then I am not valuable?
No, it's not like that. You know, maybe, you know, once a year your family will visit your grave.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, when we are talking about people,
yeah.
So, you know, someone who did not have any influence in the society.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, like, you know, the circle is going to be smaller of the people remembering him or her.
Well, I have a change of opinion over here. I think that your question is like, if you don't have any works, if you don't mm-hmm. have a book published, if you don't have a poem written, if you don't have, I don't know, other
anything accomplished, yeah.
Contributions. So, to the society, you're going to be forgotten. I think, I still think, like, if I don't have anything, but I can, after my death, live for years, if I live better life right now. For example, if I practice patience, if I practice love, if I practice
modesty, morality, and everything like
it's
that.
It's going to get transmitted into my generations. Mm-hmm. And when I am patient and next of my generations, this transmitted into them, that patient, and then my generations are actually showing that patience. I'm living again. My soul is again, like, happy.
So here's a point I would like to add it after we go for a break. Welcome back, dear listeners of Back to Reality, where we are talking about this very fascinating topic of the thing that says, after my death, there'd be no more of me. And that is really sad. And then you both were just saying that, okay, after we die, if we have accomplished something, if we have a generation,